University of Texas Dallas on Wednesday night. Police have been accused of using brute force against demonstrators. The protests started in Columbia University on April 18th and spread nationwide. Journalist and podcaster Asa Wynn Stanley says U.S. police uses tactics similar to what Israeli forces do in the occupied West Bank to oppress students.
Overnight attacks by Zionist gangs in UCLA against the student encampments. It seems very much like a pogrom. It seems very much like this was allowed by the police forces, right? That this was not some sort of grassroots violence. It can't have happened with at least the complicity of the police forces. We saw how quickly the police forces were to act against the students, against the peaceful students, but when these armed violent Zionist gangs are allowed for hours to attack the students, you know, there must be some sort of coordination happening there. And again, that's a similar dynamic to what we see in the occupied West Bank with the Israeli occupation forces working hand in glove with violent settler militias, for example, to attack Palestinians and to displace and to remove Palestinians from their land. I'm not saying the two situations are the same, of course, but, you know, we see similar military techniques being used in some ways.
University students and professors in Iraq have rallied at a Baghdad campus in solidarity with Gaza and pro-Palestinian student protests at U.S. universities.
If the storming of Columbia University had happened in another country, especially in a third world one, they would have turned the world upside down. We witnessed brutal stormings and severe violations in the so-called land of democracy. We believe it's indeed a democracy, but these scenes were shocking, seeing the way they've dealt with voices raised to support a cause, not just an Arab or Islamic one.
Their narrative has been exposed and people will no longer believe it, especially as we see how the students, who are the foundation of society, have it started to demonstrate for Palestine. This is the beginning of change for Palestine and the start of liberation, God willing. It's incredibly positive to witness American universities previously unaware of Palestine are now engaging in demonstrations, raising the Palestinian flag and advocating for the rights of the Palestinian people. This brings us great joy. It also sparks a sense of envy, prompting us to question why we haven't participated in this movement ourselves.
The protesters demanded an immediate cessation of U.S.-Israeli onslaught on Gaza. They carried banners calling for a free Palestine. A similar protest was also staged at the Lille School of Journalism in northern France. Students there condemned Israel's genocidal war and siege on the Gaza Strip. The protest caused the classes to be canceled for the day.
It was important for us as students in general, and not just students at Sciences Po, to mobilize, because it's a total injustice. And above all, we can see that, given the media coverage and what is currently happening in France, there is no real fight for the survival and well-being of the Palestinian people. As students, that's what we're denouncing, the positions of our government, the positions of the Israeli government, and the media coverage.
We are demonstrating for democracy, for freedom of expression, for everything, in fact, to stop all this oppression in France and all across the world. We are here for the humanist struggle before any political struggle.
We're doing this because it's urgent, because we have to. We're here and we're expressing ourselves like this because we have to. This is no longer possible. It's been going on for months and we're here to say no, we're stopping everything. We're even blocking our own educational centers because we have to act now.
A Muslim civil rights and advocacy group, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, has censured U.S. lawmakers for approving a bill aimed at criminalizing any criticism of Israel. The Council's criticism came after the so-called Anti-Semitism Awareness Act passed the U.S. House of Representatives by a wide margin on Wednesday. The Republican-led measure that equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism would smear Israel's critics amid the war in Gaza. The advocacy group says the bill is aimed at stifling the voice of American students advocating for Palestinian human rights. The bill was tabled at the time when several universities have been the scene of anti-Israeli protests over the regime's genocidal campaign in Gaza. This day 209 of the Israeli genocide in Gaza, the regime continues to massacre civilians by pounding the blockaded territory with airstrikes and artillery fire. In the latest attack, one person was killed and five others injured after their home was shelled in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. A woman was killed in a similar attack in the southern Gaza city of Al-Fukhari. In northern Gaza, Israeli warplanes struck a home in the Jabalia refugee camp. The regime also bombarded the electricity distribution company in the central city of Deir al-Balah. Since the onset of the Israeli war last October, nearly 34,600 Gazans have been killed, most of them women and children. However, the actual death toll is believed to be much higher, as thousands remain under the rubble. The death toll is in addition to more than 77,800 people who have been injured. Nearly 7 months of Israeli bombing and shelling campaign has not only turned a large part of Gaza into rubble, but has decimated its healthcare system. Israeli restrictions on goods are also preventing life-saving medical supplies from reaching the few remaining hospitals. Yemen's Ansarullah leader says the country's anti-Israeli operations will expand further in the Red Sea as well as the Indian Ocean.
The number of ships that have been attacked has become 107, linked to the Zionist enemy and with the Americans. The general number of the operations that have been carried out since the beginning of the Battle al-Aqsa storm have reached 156 in the Red Sea and Bab al-Mandab and the Gulf of Aden, the Arabian Sea, reaching up to the Indian Ocean and also southern occupied Palestine, and 606 ballistic and winged missiles and drones were used ever since the beginning of the operations in support of the Battle al-Aqsa storm until Wednesday. And we also warn of a fourth round of escalation if the Israeli enemy continues to behave stubbornly along with the Americans. There is a fourth round of escalation which we are preparing for against the enemy, because thank God we have made achievements in the escalation and in further improving the military capabilities. So I hope, God willing.
Abdul Malik al-Houthi added Yemen's operations have successfully impacted the economies of Israel and its allies. He also hailed the steadfastness of resistance groups in the besieged Gaza Strip. The leader of the Ansarullah movement was addressing Yemeni people in a televised speech. He said that Israel has not achieved any of its goals of the onslaught on Gaza. Elsewhere in his remarks, al-Houthi condemned the violent crackdowns by U.S. police on student protests at universities across the country. He said the move exposes the true nature of U.S. authorities. A top commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says only a fraction of Iran's available military resources were used in the anti-Israel operation dubbed True Promise last month.
There are untold points. I tell you that it was a part of a force. We in fact planned our operation that night in a way that from all the facilities we had prepared for the action, we used 20% for punishment.
The commander of the IRGC's Aerospace Division, Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh, said a small force prompted the U.S. and some of its allies to deploy combat ships and aircraft carriers in support of Israel. Hajizadeh attributed the success of the operation to the unwavering determination of Iranian forces and the wisdom of the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On April 14th, Iran launched extensive missile and drone strikes on Israeli positions in the occupied territories, with some missiles hitting the intended targets. The strikes were in response to a deadly Israeli attack on the consular section of Iran's embassy in Damascus. The Islamic Republic had made it clear that its punitive action was based on Article 51 of the UN Charter regarding the legitimate defense in response to an aggression. Iran has imposed sanctions on certain U.S. and U.K. individuals and entities over their role in Israeli crimes in the West Asia region. The Foreign Ministry announced the new curbs, saying that they are in line with the Iranian law called Countering Human Rights Violations and Adventurous and Terrorist Acts of the U.S. in the region. The ministry said the sanctions target those who are involved in Israeli terrorism and violation of human rights, especially of Palestinians in Gaza. The sanctions cover five entities and seven individuals for providing weapons, money, and other assistance to Israel. The blacklisted entities include arms and ammunition manufacturing corporations, such as Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Skidio, Chevron, and Haran. Several former and incumbent figures are on Iran's sanctions list for their role in Israeli atrocities. South Africa's ruling alliance has marked International Workers' Day with calls for continued solidarity with Palestine and other countries which are facing attack from Western hegemony. The ruling ANC's leadership was out in full force at programmers across the country to show their support. Hassan Seria has more from Cape Town.
The celebration for May Day began with a protest for an end to the Israeli colonial project in Palestine. Because, quite simply, the struggle of workers around the world is intrinsically linked to that of the Palestinian struggle against occupation. So as tens of thousands of demonstrators turned out in cities across the country, Palestine was the central theme. For the ANC, Palestine is an important rallying call, especially due to the political party's own history as a liberation movement. Workers' Day, therefore, presents an important opportunity and a timely reminder to realign the masses' commitment to Palestinian liberation. Speaking at a rally after the march, President Cyril Ramaphosa illustrated how the words of anti-apartheid icon Nelson Mandela remains true for South Africa, as the colonial apartheid project year has left an insidious legacy, which means that 30 years after achieving democracy, South Africans are yet to realize full liberation.
We needed to deal with the damage that was done by apartheid. We still need to complete the work that we set ourselves out to do. We still need to return the land to those who work the land. We still need to ensure that the harm that was done against our people when they were forcibly removed from their land and houses should be addressed. And we still need to provide our people with basic requirements for a decent life.
But the underpinnings which drive global forces of hegemony are beginning to falter. And so the vicious brutality of the Zionist regime is a representation of the turmoil neoliberalism finds itself in.
Liberalism itself is in crisis, is in decline. It's in a moral crisis, in a moral degeneration. It is causing wars, genocides across the world in order to protect few countries, the so-called G7 countries. That's why today we have the occupier state of apartheid Israel as a regime that has taken over the land of Palestinians, supported by international capital, committing genocide of women and children and the people of Palestine week in, week out.
As some Western-backed political parties here still try to protect and implement hegemonic policies, the rallying call this May Day was that with an election looming, South Africans need to vote wisely. Hassan Siriab, Cape Town.
Activists in Seoul marked Global Day of Action to end arms transfers to Israel, with peace advocates and lawmakers performing a die-in across from the office of President Yoon Suk-yeol. They say that South Korea's tens of millions of dollars in arms trade with Israel must end, and that Hyundai must stop selling Israel equipment to demolish Palestinian homes for Israeli settlements. Frank Smith has more from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
With their die-in mimicking the Israeli bombing of Gaza, South Korean peace campaigners' Global Day of Action demanded the country stop sending arms that fuel Israel's genocide. South Korea has seen its weapons trade with Israel grow significantly over the past decade.
South Korea has sold weapons worth $47 million to Israel over the past 10 years. Exports increased year by year.
And South Korea's arms exports to Israel carried on despite Israel's massacres of civilians.
Even when the Israeli military strikes refugee camps and destroys hospitals, and even when the International Court of Justice determines that the Israeli military is committing genocide in Gaza, arms exports continue.
Last February, South Korea amended a law doubling the financing available for arms exports. With Israel's genocide in Gaza, arms trade to Israel is banned under international convention. South Korea is a party and the U.S. a signatory to the Global Arms Treaty, which says that states should not transfer arms if it knows those weapons will be used to commit genocide, war crimes, or attacks on civilians. Despite various international agreements related to the arms trade, enforcement is lacking.
On April 5th, the UN Human Rights Council passed a resolution to stop arms exports to Israel. But because it's non-binding, no decision to suspend exports has actually been made official. And now our voices are being heard more in such mass movements and UN resolutions.
Activists have been documenting Israel's genocide and war crimes, as estimations now suggest thousands of people, mostly women and children, have been killed by Israel and the weapons it imports from the U.S., Germany, Italy, South Korea, and elsewhere. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Discovering Islam.
After birth, death is the greatest event in every person's life. It is the most private experience of every individual that cannot be shared with anyone else. Their death is followed by the destruction of the body as we know. However, would that mean the total destruction of the person? Why do we die at all? What is the philosophy of our temporary life on this earth? Why is death so scary for many people? Is the dichotomy of soul and body true? And if that is the case, what is the soul and how would it leave the body?
If there is one thing that we can be certain of, it's that we will die. Yet, death remains one of the greatest mysteries that man has ever known.
There is a definition of death which doctors give us, which is when the brain waves or the electrical waves in the brain stop. That would be counted as death.
Scientifically, death is the cessation of all biological functions that maintain a person.
Roughly 150,000 people die around the world each day, so it should be one of the most familiar subjects for all. Most people wish that they never have to think about it or face death, and they're even scared to think about it.
If you ask someone to enter a room and no one would be able to leave that room and come back and give you an experience of how it felt to go into that room, many people would hesitate to enter that room. In the same way, when it comes to death, many people who have died and none of them have returned back to life to give us or share with us how they experienced that death or where did they go. So it's a transition to, for us in this world, and for many, somewhere unknown.
The word death conjures up an idea of the end of things. When we use death in English, we say when something dies, it seems to us almost to mean that it is now useless. It can be discarded. It has no value. It has lost its vitality. But it's not a very good word, or it hasn't taken a very good meaning in that way, because in Islam, death is a transference, according to many hadiths, from one abode to another abode. It is like walking through a doorway. If you call a doorway death, fine. It certainly is not an end to life. It is a continuation to life.
You know, we can understand why people find it uncomfortable to talk about death. And one of the reasons is because of the intense love we have for the world. And death signifies a departure from these attractive, beautiful things of the world.
All cultures correspond death with frightening thoughts and images. The reason for that is because we look at it from the departure side, because we are scared to leave what we are very much familiar with to the unknown. However, if we were to see it as an arrival, we find it to be more of a blessing than a loss.
It's a shedding of clothes. It's taking, I don't know, you can say a shower and cleaning the filth from your body. So in other words, it's an existential thing. It's not absence of something. Unlike what we are brought up being taught, or directly or indirectly, about how death is absence of life. No, life, is, as we know it, is something that has different stages in Islam. So it's not that we have life and then death. Life continues. We just have to shift. We have to cross the bridge. Imam Hussein alayhi salam on Ashura, he would tell his companions that, be patient. Death is nothing but a bridge where you're crossing to go to the better stuff, to higher levels of existence and life, actually.
We are born for eternity, and death, unfortunately, is taken negatively as if it means the end. The Islamic explanation is that death is just a transfer. It's a gateway to enter the second, or the stage after this current stage. Stage one is this life. Stage two is transition between this life and the afterlife, the barzakh. Stage three, eternity.
What's important to realize is it's all like what we call the circle of life. There was the side of the human being descending from the higher up to dunya. And that's why dunya is called dunya, because it's at the bottom of the cycle. Okay. And then it will start to ascend back again to where it came from. And that's when the soul is separated from the body and the nafs goes back. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
Islam's picture of life and death is part of a broader process, part of a bigger process. It is simply a gateway into that which is to come.
Death is really the bridge that unites the lover with his beloved, meaning that, you know, man who loved his Lord, he now wants to meet his beloved, his creator.
Man is a traveling creature. He starts from a drop, to clinging mass, to a fleshy tissue, to a fetus, to a baby, to a child, to a youth, to an adult, to an early and eventually to the grave. But is the journey going to stop here? Is this the end? Or there are other stations to this uninterrupted journey?
We have a verse in the Quran, Ya ayyuha al-insan innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadhan famulaqih. O man, you're moving towards your Lord, you're traversing a path towards your Lord, and you will eventually meet Him. This shows that we're on a journey, and life is a journey, and it ends with meeting our Lord. Does this journey end with death? The answer to this is that if we look at what the definition was in the beginning of life, then we will understand that life doesn't end with death. And since life doesn't end with death and is continuous, then so the journey continues as well.
The baby's journey to the world is full of wonders, and the elderly travels to the grave is even more wondrous. Now, based on Islamic teachings, death is ripeness of the soul and its readiness to be picked and initiated into the wonders of a new life. It is the tunnel to a phenomenal world of wonders.
The death, as we know it, is not an end to life. Rather, it is a portal, a doorway into a new and more expansive existence. And indeed, as we move on in this journey from this dunya into barzakh and then later on to the day of judgment, we are constantly evolving and changing. We're not dying.
But where is the destination of this journey? How many more stations are out there? Where is the map for this long travel?
We're here for eternity. We're born for eternity, not for death. Yes, since death is going to take us closer to that eternity, then in a sense you can say we're born to die. But not we're born to die in the sense that we are born for absence of life. No, we are born so that eventually we will be transmitted from one level of existence in life to the next level of existence in life to eventually attain that eternity we were born for.
Some say there is no afterlife, but they only assume. And why should we follow their assumption? Why should we think that this journey should stop so abruptly? Why should man, this traveling creature, stop traveling? If he were to stop, why did he set out? Why shouldn't we follow those who claim knowledge of that side and listen to those who only assume?
Somebody recently sent me a picture of twins in the womb of mother. One of them arguing that there is no life after birth, another saying there is life after birth. So in the similar way, we are in this world. Those who believe, they are arguing there is no life after this world, and others saying there is life after this world.
I believe there is an afterlife, but I believe it cannot be objectively proven. It is something which you need to go inward through introspection, through interaction with Allah, and seeing the signs in your life. I believe the afterlife can be discerned from this life itself.
We started from that drop of water, and we are where we are now. However, for the final destination, we need more progress. The Quran gives us some preview of what we may expect in our progress into future. We have to be prepared for that great encounter, meeting with the Lord, the Creator. He wants to share with us what he has. وَبَشِّرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ بِأَنَّ لَهُمْ مِنَ اللَّهِ فَضْلًا كَبِيرًا. He loves that you live beside him, pure and honest. فِي مَقْعَدِ صِدْقٍ عِنْدَ مَلِيكٍ مُقْتَدِرٍ. He's waiting to meet you and to live with you forever. خالدين فيها نزلا من عند الله.
Death is an astonishing path through the world of wonders. Some people have had flavors of that adventurous dimension on many instances of near-death experience.
Near-death experience is a personal, involuntary experience in which the person will see itself outside the body and while in a condition of a crisis like an accident or a surgery, and the person will be considered clinically dead, but then eventually the person will come back. And in the case of the near-death experience, the person will have a recollection of what happened during this period in which he or she was completely considered dead.
In his book, Life After Life, The Investigation of a Phenomenon, Survival of Body Death, the American psychologist and medical doctor Raymond Moody has compiled huge data and presented extensive analysis on near-death experience. He's classified the experience of 150 patients with near-death experiences into several categories. Now, one group experienced that they left their bodies while they were absolutely conscious and could observe the efforts of the medical team. Another group felt that they were okay in a body different from their physical body. Now, Moody uses the term spiritual body for this.
In the case of the near-death experience, it happens when the person is close to death or when this person is actually considered dead, which means no heartbeat, no brain activity whatsoever. So in this case, what happens is that the person will experience different things that we cannot see here, and the person will normally have some characteristics. For example, the person will hear sometimes noises that we call it intracranial sounds. It just happens inside of their heads. Then normally they see a tunnel. Many times they see a light at the end of the tunnel. So they float, or sometimes they just go quickly towards the light.
Other experiences implied losing the sense of physical time, peace and tranquility, confusion as a consequence of leaving the physical body. Another group reported that they saw a prominent religious personality in a body made of light.
Some others stated that initially they did not realize they were in a new body until they found out that the hearing and their vision of their relatives was too weak to see or hear them, although their own senses had intensified so that they could hear and see new things.
What these studies tell us is that, firstly, our knowledge about human being is much less than what we assume. And secondly, we have to confess that our current scientific tools are inadequate for these novel areas of research. And finally, and most importantly, not everyone has the same experience of death.
يَعْلَمُونَ ظَاهِرًا مِنْ الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا, the Quran says. People appreciate only very surface aspects of the creation. وَهُمْ بِالْآخِرَةِ هُمْ غَافِلُونَ, and they're oblivious of the expansive nature of what I have really created.
Generally, death is an experience similar to the birth of a baby, where it travels from one world to another. The difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, while the baby's soul is extremely astute and can feel the difference. By entering into that realm, the soul moves one step closer to its completion, and its power to comprehend the realities of existence would increase. Hence, it is now one stage nearer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord. A meeting which is not like meeting of a person with another person, but meeting of two worlds.
The whole purpose of this worldly life, this transient, ephemeral and fleeting 70 or 80 years, is that we prepare our souls
we make them ready and fit for the divine proximity and divine neighborhood, so that we become the neighbors of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We become fit to have that beatific vision in paradise.
The soul is very difficult to define, but in a simple expression, it is what we call I, the one who wills, who decides, who judges, who loves and hates, the one who uses the body as a means towards its end. We usually think that these are functions of the mind, while the mind is a simple conglomeration of absolutely separate cells.
We have to see what defines a person. Is it the body, or is it the me within the body? When we're growing up as kids, we have that me in us. As we grow older, we feel that this same me that I had when I was a kid is still that same me. Of course, experiences are added to me, but the me is the same me. We can't fool ourselves. As we grow older and older, the same me again and again. So, does the person die? We have to see. The body will die for sure. The body is destroyed for sure. But the person, no. The person will live on. That me, or in other words, the soul, is going to live on.
Meccans asked the Prophet, tell us what the ruh is. What is the spirit? He said, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الرُّوحِ قُلِ الرُّوحُ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. They ask you about the soul, what it is. Tell them that the soul is my Lord's command. And that's all you can understand. You can't understand more than that. And of course, you know, when I say you can't understand more than that, you know, some people will say, well, we live in a very enlightened age of science and technology and information, and we have everything on our fingertips. But let me tell you, you know, the best minds in physics, the best minds in biochemistry, the best minds in genetics, best minds in technology and engineering and in every field will say to you, we only know this much. We only know this much of the physical world.
It is true that the soul knows this world by the help of body and its different organs. And if it was not for the body, the soul would have not known anything. It is as the Quran mentions, وَاللَّهُ أَخْرَجَكُمْ مِنْ بُطُونِ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا وَجَعَلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. God has brought you forth from the wombs of your mothers while you did not know anything. He made for you hearing, eyesight and hearts so that you may appreciate. Mutually, if it was not for the soul, the body would not have been able to do anything. Death happens when the soul leaves the body. The question is, what would the soul do without the body, which was its only means to every end? The answer is that it lives in another body.
When you die, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts your soul in another body. Now, let's say it like this. You have a body in the once you die as well. And you will eat, you will drink, and so on. Or you will be punished to an extent. And this is called the mithali body, they call it. Which means that you have that same shape and form, but you don't have material anymore. Okay? So you have height, width, maybe length, but you don't have that material. Okay? It's not something tangible. And that's why we, in this realm of life, we can't see those who have passed away.
The soul is the real us. The body is a vehicle. That's why when, for example, we look in the mirror and we say, I, we don't mean this body with its limbs. If we were to lose a hand tomorrow and look in the mirror, we'll still say I and mean the same thing. We won't say I less five fingers. So we have an understanding of the real us, who we refer to as I. This soul requires, depending on which environment it is in, a body of sorts, and there will be a more subtle body that it occupies as it moves on into barzakh, and an even more subtle body that it occupies when it moves into the day of judgment.
Death is really a move from one realm of existence into another. It is moving from the physical world, the material world, the touchable world, the tangible world, into the realm of spirit, the realm that is spiritual. the realm that is beyond and above the laws of physics, really. Gravitation or material or physical things actually don't exist in that world. It's a world of its own, with its own laws and with its own way of operating.
That spiritualistic communication or spiritualistic sense is simply that sense which is not materialistic, the sense which is got that third component, if we may call it.
Rumi refers to these senses in his famous book, Masnavi. There are five senses other than these five senses. Those are like red gold, while these are like copper. The prophets communicated with the angels through these senses, and the Prophet of Islam went to Mi'raj, the ascension, with his spiritual body, and heard and saw things by his spiritual senses. These senses will be activated for all after they die.
In this world, the soul is not able to manifest its true potentials. It is governed largely by the constraints of the material world around it. And it is an uneasy, if you like, passenger in the vehicle that is the body. However, there is a purpose to this existence, and the soul requires to have this phase of its existence. But it really, if you like, flies and flourishes once it is free from that fetter of the body, and that is real life.
The spiritual body grows with us as we grow in this world. In fact, we have one aspect of this rooted in the middle world, and that is why we can communicate with that world in our dreams. So in this world, we live in two bodies, but since one is like an image of the other and completely matched on it, we realize that. Now, these two bodies belong to two dimensions of the same existence. On the moment of death, the soul discards its physical body and leaves this world with its spiritual body. So when we talk of death, we actually talk of ourselves in a new body, a body which is much more complicated and much more magnificent than our physical body.
The awareness, the power of the soul that is available to it, even in Barzakh, is exponentially different to that which was available to it in life. Even the kafir and the agnostic and the atheist, their ma'rifah and knowledge of reality is much greater than any scholar who's alive now, because the veils have been lifted and they see.
So every one of us leave this world in a spiritual body, a body which is lighter, fresher, and more agile than the body in which we are living now. A body with a special DNA partially created by us in this world. But what type of experience is death? Isn't going to be the same for all? Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about this in more details. Until then, peace be with you.
The Limelight.
The vast majority of Gaza are currently living in tents, located in makeshift camps, due to the Zionist regime's systematic targeting of UN shelters, schools, hospitals, and even mosques and churches. Living in a tent, however, is not equivalent to safety, as many airstrikes and artillery shelling have targeted the encampments across various regions of the besieged Gaza Strip.
In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The Palestine Chronicle spoke with two Palestinians currently displaced in the city of Deir al-Balah in the central Gaza Strip. Amid the unparalleled scale of death and destruction, at least 1.9 million people were displaced by the Zionist regime's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, according to UN figures. The total population of Gaza, at least prior to the war, was 2.3 million people. The vast majority of these people are currently living in tents, located in makeshift camps, due to Israel's systematic targeting of UN shelters, schools, hospitals, and even mosques and churches. Living in a tent, however, is not equivalent to safety, as many airstrikes and artillery shelling have targeted the encampments across various regions of the besieged Gaza Strip. Moreover, the living conditions in the tents are extremely poor, especially following an unusual heat wave in the Gaza Strip, which reportedly already killed 2 children. Philip Lazzarini, UNRWA Commissioner General, explained recently that Palestinians living in the tents have to endure death, hunger, disease, displacement, and now living in greenhouses-like structures under scorching heat. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with two Palestinians currently displaced in the city of Deir al-Balah in the central Gaza Strip. Hajja Shaima al-Isawi is living in a tent with her family after escaping from the Hamad towers in the southern city of Khan Yunis, which was targeted by the occupation forces. Al-Isawi told the Palestine Chronicle, "The tent is extremely hot, and the overall situation is very difficult. There are insects everywhere, and the heat is intense, and it's impossible to adapt to this life," she added. "Children suffer from everything. Although we constantly clean the tent, there are insects everywhere." Al-Isawi and her family remained homeless when the Zionist regime completely destroyed the city of Hamad. She said, "We managed to buy an apartment in Hamad with great difficulty. We were very happy, but the occupation did not give us time to enjoy living in it. When the war broke out, we were forced to flee from our house, and we found out that it was completely destroyed." Al-Isawi fled to the Nuseirat refugee camp and then settled in Deir al-Balah, she said. "We spent the winter struggling with severe cold in the tents, and now we are suffering from the heat." Al-Isawi's husband, who suffers from heart disease, expressed his desire to go back to Hamad, so they decided to go back, and they lived in their destroyed house for a week, she explained. "Then the occupation forces invaded the city again, and it was a very difficult week under intense bombardment. When they tried to leave, however, they were forced to cross Israeli checkpoints. On their third attempt, Israeli occupation forces arrested Al-Isawi's husband, while the rest of the family managed to return to the tents in Deir al-Balah." She said, "My husband has a heart condition and cannot endure torture or imprisonment. I hope he will be released soon," she said in a shaky voice. "Our life means nothing without him. We rely on him for everything. We hope the war will end and we can live in safety." Even amid extreme conditions, however, Palestinians continue to show incredible resilience. Many refugees decided to organize activities and set up schools in the encampments to allow children to study despite the war. Haj Akram al-Ajuri fled from Jabalia refugee camp in the north to Nuseirat in central Gaza and remained there for a month. When the Zionist regime forces invaded Nuseirat, al-Ajuri and his family headed to Rafah, where they stayed for a month and a half. Later, they returned to Nuseirat for 20 days before settling in tents in the city of Deir al-Balah. Al-Ajuri told the Palestine Chronicle, "In all the encampments, I have organized beautiful activities for the displaced people, including events to praise the Prophet Muhammad." He explained, "One of the refugees, who was a teacher, dedicated a tent to educate children." Al-Ajuri added, "The occupation deprived our children of education since the beginning of the war. Therefore, these activities are very important. We will look for other activities to support our children. We hope the war will end soon and the suffering we endure will end and we can return to our homes safely, God willing."
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. U.S. police storm several colleges and arrest more students as unrest over Israel's onslaught against Palestinians in Gaza simmers on campuses. The U.S. Israeli genocide continues for the 209th day, with the death toll nearing 34,600, mostly women and children. In Yemen, Nasrallah leader warns the U.S. and U.K. of more naval operations against their vessels and destroyers if the aggression on Gaza does not stop. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. U.S. police have stormed the protests and campus at the University of California amid similar crackdown on pro-Palestine sit-ins on other campuses in the country. Police made several arrests as the protesting students had defied the warning that they either disperse or face detention. Protest is part of a divestment movement in the U.S. and other countries. Pro-Palestine students demand authorities in their respective universities to stop financial ties with companies that have linked or links with the Israeli regime. They also want an end to the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. Clashes have also reported at other American universities. Earlier, scuffles broke out between protesters and police at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. At New York's Fordham University, protesters chanted anti-Israeli slogans and waved Palestinian flags under heavy police presence. More than 1,500 protesters have been arrested at colleges across the U.S.